Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Army Ranger Pat Tillman, a veteran of four seasons with the National Football League's Arizona Cardinals, was killed in Afghanistan on Thursday. Tillman had turned down a three-year, $3.6 million contract to join the Army 3 years ago. Arizona Senator John McCain yesterday said of Tillman that, quote, he viewed his decision as no more patriotic than that of his less fortunate, less renowned countrymen who loved our country enough to volunteer to defend her in a time of peril. The NBA playoffs have so far delivered few surprises, but that could change any day. Today, for example. Joining me now to explore that possibility is Eric Neal, who writes about basketball for ESPN.com. Eric, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Indiana took Game 3 in Boston last night. Do the 2004 Pacers, who now own a 3-0 lead in that series, strike you as a championship-caliber squad?
I think there's a very good chance they end up in the finals. I don't see them beating any of the teams out of the West, and I actually prefer it that way because I think the teams out West play a more entertaining brand of ball. What's going to keep Indy close in a series with anybody in the West is that they slow things way down, and that can keep you in it.
Okay, for the record, you are speaking to me from the far coast, the West Coast,
it's
and
true.
That bias is apparent every time we speak.
what do the kids say? I have to represent.
Yao Ming and teammates earned their first win in their opening round series against the Los Angeles Lakers, who still enjoy a 2-1 lead there. Evidence that the SS Big Aristotle is starting to take on water and sink?
I like that very much. I think the thing with Shaq and Yao is that in Yao, he meets the one guy who can go heads up with him and present problems. The guy is, 11'9", and he can move. And as big as Shaq is, he looks reasonable next to Yao. That's the most hilarious part about watching these two go heads up. So I don't think the Rockets win this series, but it's nice to see them give a little pushback to Shaq and crew.
The New Jersey-New York series has had its share of interesting stories, ranging from the verbal war between the Knicks' Tim Thomas and the Nets' Kenyon Martin to the possible exit of Hall of Fame coach Lenny Wilkins. The only thing absent, I think, has been good basketball, or do you agree?
It is pretty ugly stuff. I think the big surprise in this series is that everyone expected that Stephon Marbury of the Knicks was going to play better than he has. Everybody knew Jason Kidd would be a little rusty coming off an injury, and that it might take a while for the Nets to get ramped up into their sort of peak performing condition. But the Knicks have looked even uglier than I anticipated, and I got to say I haven't watched much of it. And I don't recommend you do either.
The Grizzlies amazed as they headed into the playoffs, but they're currently down 3-0 against San Antonio. Maybe it's just not the year for Memphis, even though Hubie Brown was coach of the year.
Yeah, this is my heartbreaker. And the game on Thursday night was just so close for Memphis. This is a great team of young kids who are working really hard for a coach they believe in. And it's just been an exciting team to follow all year with the way they turned it around. A lot of people will tell you that the key to Hubie's influence on this team is that he's experienced and he brings wisdom of all his years of coaching. And I think that's true, but I've seen this team up close working with him. And the big thing Hubie brings is enthusiasm and energy every day. And it sounds counterintuitive, but those kids are feeding off the 70-year-old.
Denver and Dallas have thus far been unable to win games in the playoffs. Has this been an especially lackluster first round, even by NBA standards, or are the brilliantly played series on hold until the second round or the third round?
Hope springs eternal, right? I think it has been a pretty lackluster first round, in part because you got a lot of matchup problems in some of these series. The Sacramento-Dallas series has been entertaining, and those games have been close, and their style of play moving it up and down quickly and really kind of getting out and running has been fun to watch. But Sacramento has been able to go inside, and that's been the X factor for them. I think second-round series will certainly be better. You know, when we get to conference finals, we may see the best ball. The NBA finals may actually be anticlimactic, I think.
Detroit and Milwaukee are tied at one game apiece. Will Milwaukee stun the basketball world with a series upset over the Eastern Conference's third seed?
No. But they might have some fun along the way. They put points on the board. Michael Redd is a terrific player to watch. He finds ways to get himself open that are pretty surprising night in and night out. And I think Detroit came in thinking they had this one in their back pockets before they got started. So that's always kind of fun to see somebody get a wake-up call. I suspect they'll close the series out pretty easily, but it may be, you know, a little nip and tuck in a couple more games before they do it.
The NBA postseason began last Saturday, but we don't begin to get into any game fours until tomorrow. Who benefits? What kind of team benefits from the slow pace at which the NBA playoffs are conducted?
The Lakers benefit because they're old, so there's plenty of time to, you know, ice up the knees and stretch. I think the league benefits from, you know, a television marketing standpoint. The other teams that benefit, you know, it's tough to say. In the first round, I think it's pretty much even across the board. It might be a little bit hard on the young teams like Memphis and Denver who want to get back into it right away because they've been frustrated in their first couple of games.
It is, of course, a very long playoff season. Lots still to happen. But still, I'm tempted to put you on the spot and ask for your prediction regarding the NBA Finals at this point.
Well, as I said, I think Indiana gets there. And I think they'll have an easier path than Detroit will. And I think they'll get through. And I think they'll probably face Sacramento, who has really yet to click but has shown me a lot of sort of moxie against Dallas in what I thought would be a tougher first couple of games. So I see Sacramento getting there, and I think they win it all.
Eric Neal is a columnist for ESPN.com, and he joins us from time to time here on Only a Game. Thank you, Eric.
Thanks so much, Bill.
The New Orleans Hornets have fallen behind 2-0 against the Miami Heat in the first round of the NBA playoffs. That's the last place the Hornets expected to be at the start of this season. They had averaged better than 46 wins over the past 4 years, and forward Jamal Mashburn and guard Baron Davis were among the league's best players. But Mashburn was left off the Hornets' playoff roster after he complained that his recent injuries were misdiagnosed by the team doctor. And as Ron Schachter reports, some fear the team's reversal of fortune may keep the fans from swarming to Hornets games.
New Orleans fans haven't had much to cheer about lately. After a 17-7 start this season, their second in the Big Easy, the Hornets fell from the heights of the NBA East, lost home court advantage to current playoff opponent Miami, and had to fend off lackluster teams like Milwaukee, Boston, and Cleveland just to make the playoffs, leaving embattled coach Tim Floyd to explain a regular season that was hardly regular.
It's October 31st. We're opening up. And coaches, players, fans, you need to understand we're not going to have Mashburn for 63 games. We're not going to have Courtney Alexander for 82 games. We're not going to have Wesley for 20. And we're not going to have Baron Davis for 15 games. How many games do you think this team can win, given that they won 47 a year ago?
The answer was 41, to go along with 41 defeats, narrowly avoiding what would have been the Hornets' first losing season in 11 years. To prevent an early exit from the postseason, New Orleans is depending heavily on their other Jamal, 25-year-old center Jamal McGlure. After a rebounding and scoring binge in April, McGlure was named Player of the Month for the NBA's Eastern Conference, and impressed star teammate Baron Davis along the way.
He's just a tremendous force inside. We know that, you know, once that ball hits that rim, that he's going to get the rebound, and, you know, we know we can go down to him in the low post and get buckets. He's just really emerged as one of the best centers in this league.
Neither McGlure nor Davis could do much during the Hornets' 30-point loss to Miami in Game 2 Wednesday night, but they still represent a minor youth movement on a team that's the oldest in the league. Davis, who led the Hornets in scoring this year with 23 points a game, says the team's age is a mixed blessing, especially when facing a faster Miami squad.
It's both an advantage and a challenge. You know, we're playing a team that's very young, very athletic. So we know that those are one of our disadvantages, is that we're not as athletic as they are. But, you know, we know how to play, and we know how to play in the playoffs and win in the playoffs, which we've done in the past.
The Hornets' moment of truth against Miami and their rocky regular season have come early in the relationship with their new hometown, which hasn't seen professional basketball since the Jazz abruptly departed for Utah in 1979. Jimmy Smith covers the team for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He says the Hornets took a risk when they brought NBA basketball back to the league's smallest city, and he cautions that unless the Hornets perform well in the playoffs, they may lose fan interest.
The city built New Orleans Arena on spec, hoping to get an NBA team or an NHL team. That came true when the Hornets were looking for a new home. New Orleans loves a winner, so it's going to be difficult for them to maintain the enthusiasm that they have now. It could be waning because next year they'll move into the Western Conference, which is particularly more rugged than the Eastern Conference.
How well mediocre records and postseason losses will play in this town remains to be seen. Attendance was down this year, and general manager Bob Bass agrees that there's pressure for the Hornets to go deeper into the postseason.
There always is. No question about that. This franchise has been in the playoffs so many times that, you know, getting to the second round, there's no question, there's a lot of pressure.
The Hornets will be looking to make their move when they play Game 3 against the Heat this afternoon in New Orleans. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in New Orleans.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. In a blatant attempt to reinforce an insulting stereotype, the International Law Enforcement Educators and Trainers Association staged the World Cop Donut Eating Contest in Rolling Meadows, Illinois last week. Terry O'Brien of the Lake Geneva, Wisconsin Police Department gobbled his way past 20 opponents, powering down 9.5 donuts in just 3 minutes. Officer O'Brien claimed he was destined to win because law enforcement runs in his family. Master of Ceremonies Ed Nowicki was among the impressed. "I thought they'd do 7, maybe 8," Nowicki said. "I couldn't believe 10. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, extreme mountain climbing in extremely inappropriate clothing. But first, the 2004 NFL Draft begins today in New York, and while being irrelevant is hardly a cause for celebration, it's not too bad if you are Mr. Irrelevant, the title given each year to the last overall pick in the draft. Back in 1976, Paul Salata, a former football player for the University of Southern California, devised the moniker and a week-long party for the doubtless confused draftee. But what was supposed to be a goofy one-time celebration of the underdog has turned into an annual event. Joining us now on the line is Ryan Hoag, the 262nd pick of last year's draft, hence Mr. Irrelevant of 2003. Ryan, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, happy to be here.
You played for Gustavus Adolphus, a Division III school in Minnesota. Relative obscurity, I would guess, for a football player. Was it an honor to be drafted at all?
Oh, absolutely. You know, just to be the only Division III player to be drafted was obviously an honor in itself. And, you know, when I started playing football, to be honest, I didn't have aspirations to be drafted someday. I mean, I wanted to take it to as high a level as possible, but, you know, any player really playing Division III football, you know, there's no athletic scholarships. You're really playing for the love of the game and for the love of competition.
Had you heard of the title Mr. Irrelevant before you assumed it?
I actually had, and one of my teammates had told me about it prior to the draft, and I was intrigued, but like a lot of people, there are a lot of false rumors that go along with it. Like I had originally heard that if you're Mr. Relevant, you get $1 million and you go to Hawaii
yeah.
for a week. And you know, it wasn't necessarily that far off, minus the $1 million.
Well, in fact, there is Irrelevant Week, the celebration of Mr. Irrelevant. It takes place in Newport Beach, California, just short of Hawaii,
mm-hmm.
just before the start of training camp. Tell me what happened during Irrelevant Week when you were king.
Well, you know, it truly is one of the best weeks of your life. And what they do is they set up the whole week in the months after the draft, and they really tailor it to anything you want. They knew that I enjoy golf, so one of the things I did was golf. They knew that I wanted to be a first grade teacher someday, so one of the days I went and talked to a first grade classroom. They knew that I was a bachelor, so they had a Miss Irrelevant contest for me.
Excellent.
And then there's annual things they do, like dragging the infield for the Anaheim Angels game during the seventh inning. That's something that they do. I went on the Jimmy Kimmel Show. I was actually the first, but I think they're going to start a relationship up with that, and got to be an announcer for that show. So that was a lot of fun. And then they have the big thing that they kind of center it around is the banquet. This past year was the first year they had ever done a Heisman-Lozman banquet. So being the last pick, Mr. Irrelevant, you also are considered the Lozman, and you actually get a trophy that's the replica of the Heisman trophy, but it's of a guy fumbling a football with a shocked look on his face. And
you
so
must
they,
be a terrific good sport to go along with all these things.
You know, as much jabbing and teasing as they do, you know, I'm guessing any person that was drafted in the seventh round, let alone maybe the second day, other than being maybe financially compensated a little better, you know, there's memories that I'll take away that no other person can say they have, and I'm one of 28 Mr. Relevants of all time. So,
it sounds as if it really is a lot better to be the last guy picked in the draft than say, the next to last guy picked in the draft.
Oh, absolutely, and the Relevant Week actually send out a letter to the second to last pick. This year it was some guy that got, I think, a lineman that got drafted by the Bears, and they say, sorry, you were Mr. Relevant in line or something, and they kind of joke about that. But, yeah, it's definitely it's a blessing to be drafted last, in my mind.
So is there some sort of mechanism? Is it like Miss America? You know, if something should happen to you, Mr. Irrelevant but one would step in and fulfill your duties during Mr. Irrelevant Week?
I'm not actually sure what would happen. I know in the past there was one time when a guy just didn't show up. Mr. Irrelevant, this is back in the 70s, right early on when it happened. A guy didn't show up or missed his plane or something, and they just grabbed a person that fit his profile in California, not even a football player, and they used him as Mr. Irrelevant for the week.
The Oakland Raiders released you during last summer's training camp, but you were picked up by the New York Giants and put on the practice squad. How do you feel your chances are to make a regular roster this year?
Well, can I tell you after Sunday? We'll see. We'll see what this weekend's draft holds, but you know, I feel good right now. You know, I think the fact that they did ask me back and sign me to a 2-year deal says a lot in their hope and future eyes and seeing me. You know, there's only two coaches that were held over, so it's a whole new coaching staff, but obviously all the upper management, player personnel people are still there, and they're the ones that got me on board. You know, there's seven receivers on the roster right now, and I'm confident that I can definitely compete, and I'm feeling great about my off-season workout. I'm, you know, 10 pounds more than I ever have weighed and as fast as I ever have been. So all I can do is prepare myself the best I can and just continually get better, and I've done that, and the rest will take care of itself.
On Sunday, when the current draft concludes, there will be a new Mr. Irrelevant, Mr. Irrelevant 2004. Will you be sad or relieved that the title is no longer yours?
You know, I was just talking to my mom today, and she was kind of sad, and she, you know, because I did live, you know, almost a movie star type of life for at least a week during the Irrelevant Week. And then, you know, once the draft's gotten closer, you know, I've done more and more interviews. I'll be at the draft today and tomorrow and, you know, doing interviews and on ESPN and stuff. So, you know, and I enjoy doing that type of thing. I enjoy speaking, and I enjoy being in the spotlights. And so in that sense, it'll be a little disappointing. I do kind of feel for Mr. Relevant 2004 because he is going to Oakland, and you know, I don't have necessarily that fond of memories there, and I feel bad that he's got to probably endure some of that. But everything comes to an end for a reason, and you know, I guess my crownship is up.
Professional football player Ryan Hoag is the current Mr. Irrelevant. Ryan, thank you again for speaking with me, and good luck.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. In 1808, Marie Paradis became the first woman to climb Western Europe's highest mountain, Mont Blanc. 30 years later, still hindered by a Victorian society that discouraged women from attempting athletic feats and hampered by layers of heavy clothing, Henriette d'Angeville joined her. In the next few days, another group of adventurous women will make their way up Mont Blanc, some wearing period clothing, all to honor the historic climbs of Paradis and d'Angeville nearly 200 years ago. Allison Gannett is the professional skier and adventurer leading this expedition. She joins me now from her hotel in Chamonix, France. Allison, welcome to Only a Game.
Hello, Bill.
What gave you the idea to put on almost 20 pounds of Victorian clothing and then trek up a mountain?
Well, I read Rebecca Brown's book, Women on High.
Mm-hmm.
I got very inspired by these women, what they accomplished so many years ago, 200 years ago. And I figured if they could do it back then, that I and many other women pretty much have no boundaries on their life. We just have to put our minds to what we want to do and do it.
Of course, it wasn't just the clothing that they had to wear that presented a challenge to Marie Paradis and Ms. d'Angeville as well, Henriette d'Angeville. What else did they have to overcome?
Well, they definitely had to overcome the weight of their clothing, but they also had very poor footwear. They had very little technical gear, like we have crampons and ice axes, and they have like these sticks, they call them alpenstocks, with a big hook on the end.
Mm-hmm.
So we have all this modern gear like avalanche transceivers, harnesses, crevasse rescue equipment. They had none of that.
Beyond that, of course, you live in a society and in an age which is pretty, you know, welcoming to women who want to take on physical challenges like this. This, of course, was not the case the first time around.
That's correct. I mean, these women were expected to wear corsets and, you know, stay out of the sun and look all pretty and... These women defied convention and went out there and climbed mountains and got sunburns and got muscles and took their corsets off and did all kinds of things that weren't expected of them back then.
All right. Now, you've mentioned corsets. I'm glad it was you and not me who got to do that. Are you going to be wearing a corset?
You know, these women actually took their corsets off. They would talk amongst each other, the women that were mountaineers, and kind of pass on this tip that if you wore a corset, you would really be unable to breathe at altitude. You know, and some of these women later in, would ditch their skirts, like Annie Peck Smith. She would actually hike up the foothills in her skirt and then hide her skirt under a rock.
So does being true to the historical nature of this climb mean that you have to hide your skirt under a rock at some point in the climb?
Well, my character, which is Marie Paradis, she did not hide her skirt. So we're all trying to stay true to what our character did. Each member of the expedition, all six women, are playing a different character in Mont Blanc's history. So we have Henriette, Marie Paradis, and four other characters. So it's been very interesting looking at the archives here in the museum and finding out more and more and more every day we find out what the women did here in Mont Blanc.
I understand that you just spent a couple of days in a hut at 11,000 feet getting acclimated to the elevation and also familiar with those period costumes. How's it going?
You know, the costumes, I figured they'd be difficult. They've got some benefits that I didn't expect. I'm wearing a sheepskin jacket with layers of wool underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheepskin jacket is actually blocking the wind better, and I'm staying warmer. But the bummer is when you get hot, that jacket kind of acts as a vinyl raincoat. It keeps all the moisture in there.
Not exactly wicking the heat away from
no.
your body. The
and
way
then, you know, you've got these woolen knickers and then this long wool skirt. And the wool skirt, when you're tramping through the powder, it just gets soaking wet. What we've all noticed is that when the clothing gets wet, it just stays wet.
Mm.
And when we have our modern-day clothing, you get wet. You know, as soon as you develop any body heat, the synthetic clothing just dries right away.
Well, that is certainly one respect in which this climb will differ greatly from the many climbs that you have made in modern climbing gear. How else will this be different?
Well, we have a really unusual team of athletes on the climb. We have the author and the publisher of the book, Women on High, and this is their first major expedition into the French Alps.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a new climb for them. They've only climbed in New Hampshire and New England, where the mountains are only 6,000 feet tall. And the mountains here are 15,000 feet tall with huge crevasses, huge avalanche potential. So Chamonix, as you know, you've been here. It's really awe-inspiring. I mean, the mountains just go straight up from the ground.
Alison Gannett is the expedition leader for the Women on High Historic Retrace of Mont Blanc. Alison, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Bill.
To listen to our interview with Rebecca Brown, author of Women on High, or see pictures of Alison at Mont Blanc in her period costume, log on to onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game. Scott Mackey, who hears Only a Game on WNMU in Gladstone, Michigan, emailed recently to suggest that though he enjoys the show, he'd enjoy it more if we covered men's and women's ice hockey more thoroughly. On the other hand, Nancy Dalrymple, a WBUR listener, expressed her enjoyment of Only a Game with no qualifications whatsoever, and she identified herself as the mother of a Harvard ice hockey player. Mark Travellini of Greenville, South Carolina, thoroughly enjoyed John Kalish's story on the recommissioned Armory and Track in New York, which ran on April 3rd on Only a Game. The story inspired Mr. Travellini to recount some tales of his own racing days, one of the worst of which ended with him sliding along the Armory's old wooden track, collecting splinters all over his arms, legs, and back, by which he apparently earned the nickname Woody. He wrote, "Thanks for the memory, though I can't imagine why." Several listeners wrote to comment on our discussion of charity running on last week's program. Matt Collister, who hears Only a Game on WCPN in Cleveland, emailed to ask, quote, "If serious runners run for the love of it, then what do they care if someone else gets the limelight on race day? I'm a hardcore runner, but I've always found that in a marathon there's room for everybody." Adam R. Wend of St. Louis feels differently. "We live in a competitive society," he wrote, "and it makes me sick to see all the people who want to cheat to get the recognition of those who've earned it." Charlie Schroeder's story about Mahjong in our April 10th program provoked in Mickey Williams childhood memories of his home in Minnesota during the late 20s and early 30s. He wrote, quote, "My mother and her friends played Mahjong. She had a beautiful set with ivory tiles and all. How I wish I still had it. I was fascinated with the game and how beautiful it was to look at. I'm now nearly 85 and have not played since my childhood." Finally, Susan Luago, who hears only a game on KWMU in St. Louis, wrote to say that she had enjoyed hearing the Kenyan national anthem at the end of last week's story about marathoning. I had not heard our anthem in over 10 years, she wrote. It touched my heart and brought tears to my eyes. If we've taken you back or hurled you forward, let us know. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Old-fashioned letters will reach us at Only A Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02115. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National...
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the apparently oxymoronic extreme croquet. But first, the news of the week with Charlie Pierce, who joins me by phone from Seattle. Hello, Charlie.
It's raining, Bill.
You don't have to be in Seattle for that. Ask anybody
shocked?
In Massachusetts.
Are you shocked to learn? Shocked?
Shocked. The National Football League draft begins tomorrow without Maurice Claret, who lost a pair of emergency appeals this week. Did Claret and his lawyers really feel they could challenge the authority of the mighty NFL?
Did you ever think, by the way, that you would see the names Maurice Claret and Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the same sentence ever in your life?
It's a great country.
No, I think that they probably took their shot, you know, and now Maurice will probably have to go play north of the border for a couple of years. I'm a little bit at sea of this great foo-for-aw from the NFL and its apologists about how dare he. Well, he took a shot. He didn't get it. He may be the Curt Flood of his time. As you recall, Curt Flood didn't win.
That's right.
Curt Flood lost. It took a few years for him to be vindicated. This may happen later for somebody other than Maurice Claret.
The perhaps less than mighty San Diego Chargers say they will continue with their draft plan. They're going to draft Eli Manning with the number one pick, despite Archie Manning's fatherly warning not to do that and Eli's vow to sit out the year if he's drafted by San Diego. What's the solution here?
The solution here is for San Diego to get smart and trade Eli Manning to where he wants to play. This is the first, and given the relative lifespan of an NFL player, perhaps the only time in his career he's really going to have control over what happens to him. You know, if you look at San Diego's track record, Ryan Leaf, one of the busts of all time. Drew Brees, been there for 3 years, they're already giving up on him. Maybe it's just a bad place to be quarterback.
Former NFL defensive back Pat Tillman was killed in action this week while serving in Afghanistan as an Army Ranger. 2 years ago, he turned down a $3.6 million contract offered by the Cardinals to join the Army. Do you think Tillman's example will inspire other NFL players to serve in the armed forces?
Well, it didn't at the time, so I suspect it probably won't now. This is, of course, a terrible story on so many different levels. One of the terrific things about Pat Tillman when he went into the Army and into the Rangers was that he refused to do interviews about it. People were desperate for him to tell him their story, and he wouldn't do it because it was contrary to the ethic of the organization he had just joined. Now that story will have to be told for him. I think that example should be maintained now that he's passed away. I don't think anyone should turn him into a plaster saint. I don't think necessarily anyone should turn him into a recruiting poster. He did what he did out of personal conviction. He was very modest about it, and we should allow him the dignity of that.
Thursday marked the beginning of the National Hockey League Stanley Cup second-round playoffs. It featured wins by Calgary over Detroit, San Jose over Colorado, and Philadelphia over Toronto. Not a bad night for teams that usually fail in the playoffs, if they ever get there.
Yeah, Calgary's an interesting story. Detroit, while handling the Nashville Predators fairly easily, did not play very well. And their goaltending situation is still up in the air. They have the pressure of being favorites, and Calgary's a pretty good club. That, to me, is the most interesting in the second-round series.
Mike Danton of the eliminated St. Louis Blues and 19-year-old Katie Wolfmeyer were indicted Thursday in Illinois on federal charges that they schemed to kill an acquaintance of the hockey player, whom some say is Danton's agent, David Frost. This is not the sort of skullduggery the NHL or anybody else, for that matter, wants to see.
Well, this is not the sort of skullduggery that the Borgias want to see. This is a strange story. Mike Danton was, of course, Mike Jefferson. He abandoned his family name and picked up a name of some friend of his that he played hockey with way back in the day. Now he's got this very strange murder-for-hire conspiracy. His father, Mr. Jefferson, not Danton, by the way, is in the paper saying that the agent is the tool of Satan. This is a story that's going to get a lot stranger before it gets normal.
Hubie Brown was named NBA Coach of the Year this week, Charlie. Memphis Grizzlies general manager Jerry West said, quote, "He's been able to hide some of our weaknesses." Faint praise for Hubie, wouldn't you say?
Not faint praise when you consider he got these guys into the playoffs, you know, only a few years removed from being ignored by everybody in the province of British Columbia. Hubie Brown's been an interesting case. I always maintained that Hubie Brown is the person that would be most happy if basketball were not played by, like, living, breathing human beings. If basketball was played with salt shakers on a checkered tablecloth, the guy would never lose a game. But now, here he is, 70 years old, with a real sort of a ragbag of young players in Memphis, and he's like Mr. Granddaddy Hubie. Everybody loves him.
New Philadelphia 76ers coach Jim O'Brien has announced that he is, quote, "a pretty easy person to play for." So we'll see whether Allen Iverson goes along with that in a few months.
Well, that's going to be pretty effectively determined by day three of training camp, don't you think? I think the best thing for all concerned is for Philadelphia to make a deal with Allen Iverson now, while he still has some market value. It will not be tenable with him and Jim O'Brien. Jim O'Brien is an old-school, very talented coach who did wonders with the Boston Celtics, all of whom bought into his program. And as much as I like Allen Iverson's competitive fire, that has never been the strength of his game.
WNBA star Lauren Jackson is finally cashing in on her considerable abilities as a basketball player, but she's going to Russia to do it. She's joining a team in the Russian Premier League. For the playoffs, she's going to be paid $220,000 to play either three games or five games, determining on how well the team does. Not a bad deal.
Wait a minute now. Let me see if I have this straight. The Cold War is over. We won, and our elite athletes are now going to Russia to make money?
Compounded by the fact that she's an Australian.
That, to me, is not a concern. This is going the wrong way. This is reversing the current on the great cable here.
Even as the running world celebrates Kenyans Timothy Cherigot and Catherine Ndereba for their wins in Monday's Boston Marathon, there is word out of Minneapolis that this year's Twin Cities Marathon will now pay prize money only to Americans. I wonder if this will be, as organizers hope, a boost for American athletes or a slight to elite runners from around the world.
Well, I think it will pretty well guarantee that if they make this a permanent policy, there will be nobody but Americans running the Twin City Marathon for the foreseeable future. Although we have to remember, this is prize money. It's not appearance money. I presume the appearance money will continue to be internationalized.
Yeah, but even so, wouldn't it be embarrassing if the biggest prize in the prize money went to the guy who finished 11th in the race?
I don't know. Does the check clear? If the check clears, then it's not embarrassing.
If Anheuser-Busch gets its way, soccer fans at the 2006 World Cup in Germany will not be able to buy German beer at the games. Does the Constitution of Germany or of FIFA contain bans on cruel and unusual punishment?
Gee, here's a great idea. Give a bunch of fans who are known for rioting on their best day an insult to their national pride that happens to involve beer. What a great thing. It's your sport, Bill, not mine.
Charlie Pierce was classically trained in the hallowed halls of Marquette University. He writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and, of course, joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
It's football, crazy. It's football, mad. And the football game has rocked him more than we've been since he had an intake a dozen skippies. It's plays to wash and scrub. Since Jock became a member of that terrible football club. It's football crazy, it's football mad. And the football game has rocked him more than we met since he had. And it'll take a dozen skivvies, it's plays to wash and scrub. Since Jock became a member of that terrible football club.
When Only a Game first heard about extreme croquet, there were tales of matches played on snow and frozen tundra with rubber balls and composite mallets, because traditional croquet equipment tends to shatter in the bitter cold. So perhaps it wasn't by accident that When Only a Game's Karen Given tracked down practitioners of the sport in Littleton, Massachusetts last Sunday. It was 65 degrees and sunny.
While the experts pound custom heavy-duty croquet wickets into the ground, Sarah, an extreme croquet novice, practices her swing with the equipment on hand, a plastic Easter egg left behind in one of the many natural hiding places of Bumblebee Park.
There we go. Oh, look at the height on that.
It's hard to imagine this park being good for anything other than Easter egg hunts and extreme croquet. The ground rises sharply on either side, leaving barely a single flat spot on which to position a picnic blanket. Rich Malley, a 20-year veteran of extreme croquet, watches the course preparation and tries to explain the method behind the madness.
The method is we give it to the madman, and he sets it up. In general, it's set up, you know, the overall layout's the same, you know, post, double wicket, single wicket, but the actual positioning depends on the terrain. We usually try to get a couple of easy wickets and the rest really stupidly hard. And Bob's really good at that part. He's a basically vicious man.
It was in Bob Worsak's backyard on New Year's Eve in 1984 that a few friends, caught up in the holiday spirit, shoveled the snow into piles for their first extreme croquet match. Since then, the game has outgrown the backyard, no matter how overgrown, and embraced places like Bumblebee Park. For Bob, it's not enough to place wickets on either side of a thicket or embed them deep in last fall's dead leaves. He tries to add as much confusion to the mix as he possibly can.
People go the wrong direction because we change directions all the time. They'll go right one time, one left next time. So people forget which way they're going, they forget which wicket they're going for, and we never tell anybody because there's no more fun than somebody hitting through the wrong wicket expecting to get another shot. And then, of course, they don't, and they're reminded of that.
But before the croquet can begin, those assembled must take care of the most important business of the day, the food. Bob brought four types of salsa. Someone else offers both red and white wine. And then there's the more, well, extreme option.
I got a two-day-old cheese sandwich if anybody wants
it. Yeah. Now we're talking.
I'm going to have some of that later. Leave it out in the sun for a little while.
Once the food, wine, and beer is safely stored in coolers, today's 13 players line up on the ridge for the simultaneous first shot of the day, the one that determines the playing order for the game. Just when it looks like actual croquet is imminent, a deserter ducks out of line to refill his beer.
God, we're still waiting for him.
Today,
as usual,
you're burning daylight.
Come on, I'm failing anger management.
Ready?
Yep.
One, two, three, hit.
Woohoo! Hey, this is the most fun we're going to have all day.
Starting positions determined, the game gets underway. But it doesn't take long before the bushes separating the second and third wickets claim their first victim.
Nice shot, Mitch.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
Mitch Kutis has been playing extreme croquet for four years, and he's no stranger to predicaments like this one.
I've come around. I do hold the record for the most minus points, but I've come around since then.
I think the next closest is minus 16 or something.
Yeah.
And yours is?
Minus 23.
Oh, my. So after shooting minus 23, why come back?
Good question.
Yeah, we've been asking that for 4 years. You can't find this kind of people, or, you know, just anywhere. I played one game, and I was already putting in an order for a mallet. Yeah, I said, this is too good.
Thank you.
This is better than golf, I mean.
Way better than
and it's
golf.
Free.
Yeah, it's free. It's laid back.
After a few more whacks at the ball, Mitch takes an enormous swing to launch his ball all of 18 inches. But it's enough.
There we go. We're out of here. We're out.
Most of today's 13 players are relative newcomers to this incarnation of croquet. But that doesn't mean that they're new to the concept. First-time extreme croqueteer Cleve Brown used to play a game he called Safari Croquet in college.
I think it's happened to everybody who's ever had a croquet set. You don't always have the nicely manicured lawn
to go out and set up on. So you kind of invent it as you go.
So how is this different from what you did in college?
Well, they got a couple extra rules.
18 pages.
Oh, 18
and
pages.
And we're still adding rules now.
For Bob, those 18 pages of rules distinguish his sport from the countless varieties springing up in parks and backyards everywhere. The rules cover everything from the relatively simple. If a ball shatters, a player is to replace the largest remaining piece with a new ball, to the exceedingly complex. Players can bank a bonus shot, but only if the bonus shot is one of two awarded for going through the top tier of a double-tiered wicket.
Just when you think every possible situation that can possibly come up has happened, something else happens. Somebody hits a ball into a tree, which bounces off and hits somebody. You know, you have to make a rule for that, because it might happen again.
You have to say, I might use it. That's actually the rule.
Just because I can't cheat, if I don't say that.
Oh, you can cheat.
It doesn't take long to prove that cheating is indeed allowed. Today's group includes Bob's players from Connecticut, newcomers from Massachusetts, and a few veterans from Vermont who play their own version of the game. Showing off some of the Green Mountain State's most impressive techniques, Jim Griven uses the handle of his mallet to scoop his ball out of a circular stand of bushes and thorny trees about 20 feet across. The ball floats gracefully in the air to drop just in line with the wicket.
No, that was a handle shot.
The shot is a thing of beauty and totally illegal, according to Bob's 18-page rulebook. But for Jim, differences between rules in Connecticut and Vermont or Texas and California are part of the sport.
I can never see there being like a national tournament, because I think each regional variety should have its own validity. And we're going to play again this fall in Charlemont, and we're thinking of taking whoever shows up, have different rules, and pick out of a bag the rules that we have for a game, because that way there'll be a little bit of every regional variety in it.
Debate over whose rules are best will have to wait until another day. Today's players are too busy drinking beer, smoking cigars, and giving advice to the newbies to worry about something as dull as a national standard for extreme croquet.
Still go, Jim.
You have one more shot.
You have death on the mind.
All right, you have another shot.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Littleton, Massachusetts.
Kill
somebody else.
Reload.
Just keep on killing.
You're on your way to scoring positive points.
Won't you come over, help snap down the clover and play croquet? I'll let you win every game that you're in if you'll say you'll play. We'll each take a mallet and hit the ball hard, and then we'll both chase it all over the yard. If you will come over, help tramp down the clover, play croquet.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Parati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear any part of this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or take a peek at some wicked croquet picks, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Extreme Croquet charter member Rich Malley.
I'm just in it for the fun. Most of them are in it for the blood.
Ah, well, next time we'll hear from one of the real players. Fun indeed. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Won't you come over, help tramp down the clover and play croquet? I'll let you win every game that you're in if you'll say you'll play. We'll each take a mallet and hit the ball hard, and then we'll both chase it all over the yard. If you will come over, tramp down the clover and play croquet.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.